Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The Big Sister Hotline is recorded on the stolen lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Sovereignty of these lands has never been ceded. I pay my respects to elders past and present. The Hotline is proud to be an ongoing supporter of JIRA, an Aboriginal-controlled community organisation where culture is shared and celebrated. This land always was and always will be Aboriginal, and Black Lives Matter. Big Sister Hotline, how can we help? Dear listeners, guys, gals, and non-binary pals, you're listening to the Big Sister Hotline, a weekly podcast offering frank, funny, and feminist advice on life, love, and whether or not you should break up with that no-good Nick boyfriend. Spoiler, the answer is always yes. I'm your host, Clementine Ford. I'm a writer, a content creator, a mother, and now, rather excitedly, an earthquake survivor. On this podcast, though, I act as one thing and one thing only, your honorary Big Sister. Straight shooting, no words minced, tough love, big sis. Each week I'm joined by a guest to help me answer your questions. And if you'd like yours to be considered, you can email it to me on bigsisterhotline@gmail.com, where all anonymity is assured. Special shout out to my people on Patreon, whose support allows me to make a whole bunch of things, including this podcast. This episode is proudly sponsored by the good folks at Wild Secrets, purveyors of the finest selection of adult toys in all the land. And you can use my code CLEMFORD to get 20% off all full price purchases over $80. Say no to earthquakes and say yes to bedshakes with Wild Secrets. I'm joined this week by an historian and writer whose recently published memoir, All About Eve, delivers a stunning and beautifully crafted reflection through identity, transition, and what it means to live the questions. They are the co-founder of the Spilling the Tea Transgender Writing Collective, and they volunteer with Transgender Victoria. They are Dr. Eve Rees. Welcome.
Hi, Clem. Thanks so much for having me.
It is my absolute pleasure. Your book is so beautifully written. I'm experiencing those feelings that I have with every wonderfully written book, in that I feel blessed to be able to allow the poetry of it to wash over me, and simultaneously incredibly envious of you.
That's very nice to hear. I mean, you know, I've been envious of your writing many times in the past. So, you know, it goes both ways.
That is very, very kind of you to say, but unnecessary. Your book, All About Eve, just recently was published by Alan and Unwin. And what kind of struck me as I was thinking about the two of us is that we have, I mean, there are some very clear differences, obviously, but we have quite similar connections, you and I. And I think maybe your experience in, you know, from going from the very starting point to having this book published might have been quite similar to mine, in that we share a friend in Claire Wright, the brilliant historian Claire Wright.
Yeah, we do. Claire, who is a colleague of mine at La Trobe University, has been such a core part of this journey. You know, Claire is one of the few historians in Australia who is so good at engaging, you know, with the public sphere and making history accessible, and is a marvellous communicator. And when I joined the history department of La Trobe a few years ago, Claire really took me under her wing, and we started a podcast together, and we've become really good mates. And it was Claire who really, you know, first encouraged me to start thinking about writing this book and hooked me up with her agent, who is also your agent, Jacinta, and that was sort of the route that led me to get a contract with Allen & Unwin, who is also, of course, your publisher. So, yeah, you're really correct to say we have followed this kind of similar trajectory of being, you know, supported and connected to a lot of the same people.
I had a similar experience with Claire, not in that we were working together. I am the opposite of an historian. I have no research skills to that degree. But Claire really championed me and set me up with a meeting with Jacinta, who is just obviously best agent in the world. And I guess what I'm really touching on is the power of that. What can happen when you live your life in a way that is championing other people and the ripples that that can create? Because so much beauty can come from that, and so many necessary stories can be told if people are just willing to, I guess, use all of the space that they have and expand it to other people, which is quite synchronistic in talking about how we as a society expand and recognize and understand the beauty of trans stories, which is what you write about so wonderfully in your book.
Yeah, I think, you know, Claire was one of the first people I came out to in my workplace of La Trobe. I was, you know, unsurprisingly pretty scared to come out as trans in a big institution. And Claire was so wonderfully supportive. And that was, in a way, you know, the foundation of our friendship. We kind of really bonded over that. And, you know, she's told me that she found my ability to kind of honour who I was and be prepared to go with the chaos of that, you know, well into adulthood. She found in that a sense of permission to kind of reevaluate her own life in many ways. And, you know, and so that moment, that kind of connection I had with Claire was a really powerful early insight for me into how when you speak your own truth, you open up other space for other people to speak their truth and they feel empowered. And it does have this kind of ripple effect. And then, of course, Claire went on to kind of lift me up and, you know, introduce me to so many people and really help further my career. You know, in a way, in a kind of reciprocal exchange for the way in which I had kind of opened up new ideas and possibilities for her. And it's just, yeah, really been beautiful to kind of see us both kind of thrive and grow side by side over the last few years.
I love that idea that what can be gleaned from, and the huge benefit, of course, that everyone has from being exposed to the beautiful complexity of trans narratives and trans stories, is that, you know, rather than people being stuck in this very limited idea, which has been perpetuated by media over the years, which I want to talk to you about in a minute, that these stories are only for the people who they talk about. Actually, they're for everyone, because all stories are for everyone. And what they tell us about ourselves and the way that we can live our lives is really profound and meaningful.
Yeah, that's such an important point. I mean, I think so often the stories of trans people, like the stories of any kind of marginalized and oppressed group, yeah, they really often get pigeonholed as like just, you know, just for that community. And I've read a lot of trans memoirs that were clearly kind of published and marketed in a way that they're only sort of for the trans or more broadly the queer community. And it was really important to me not to write that kind of story, because I so fervently believe that, you know, trans people, we're just humans like everyone else. And, you know, our story is kind of just a human story. And also trans people, because we're sort of positioned on the margins of, you know, what we might think of as kind of normative gender, you know, the conventional gender rules, we have so much insight and knowledge into how gender works. And of course, gender is relevant to every single human because we're all gendered. We all live under patriarchy. And so I think, you know, trans people really have so much to offer to cis people in helping them to kind of think through how gender shows up in our everyday lives, what it means for our bodies, our identities, our sense of selves. So it's, you know, I love being read by trans people, but I also really love having cis people read my work and say that it changed their thinking, because, you know, trans people have heard these ideas before that I'm talking about, but it's cis people who it often kind of blows their mind to learn to think about gender in a different way.
I can relate to that when I think about it in terms of who reads my work on feminism, you know, when I'm speaking to an audience of people who actually is not just women, obviously, it's anyone who has existed outside of the cishet male kind of conditioning of the world. When they read my work and relate strongly to it, obviously that's it's like saying like, isn't it? You know, you feel seen and welcomed and connected to your immediate community. But you have to change the thinking and the lives of people outside of those communities too, and the rewards that you can get from seeing how, I mean, in terms of myself, when I have men write to me, particularly when they're quite blokish cis men, and they confess that, you know, something I've written might have spoken to the little boy within them, and how they have been, even cis men, obviously cis people are indoctrinated into gender as well. I mean, we're the ones who police it so hard, that it's incredibly rewarding in a different way. And I guess, you know, thinking about the complexity of trans stories and the rich tapestry of trans stories, one of the things that was so fascinating to me, and I would like to think that I'm someone who is quite, you know, well versed in a lot of trans narratives. You know, I read trans writers, I listen to trans speakers, I've got lots of trans friends. You know, but it was interesting to me that you said that only 1 in 10 people in Australia can claim to know a trans person well, which is really shocking. Because, and the worst part about that was that, you know, it was in the chapter where you were talking about media representations of trans lives, which of course, up until incredibly recently, has always been, you know, swinging wildly between tragedy or monstrosity. And only recently in the last 10 years, we can say that there's been any kind of positive, widespread representation of the joy that can be lived in a trans life. And one of the things that you wrote was that if only 1 in 10 people know a trans person, that includes closeted trans people, which until you were 30, unbeknownst to you, was yourself.
Yeah, completely. I was one of those closeted trans people who, because, you know, I'd grown up at a time where I didn't see any realistic or positive or, you know, complex trans representation, being trans was literally unthinkable to me. You know, I grew up in Newcastle in the 90s and early 2000s. It was a super like white, straight, you know, kind of Aussie white bread culture. You know, great beaches, not a lot of cultural diversity. And I think, you know, when I first sort of started to think of myself as trans, I really grappled with a sense of imposter syndrome, because I thought, well, why didn't I know when I was younger? Like, surely if I was really trans, I would have known when I was 4 or 5 years old, and I would have been insisting upon that from that age. But the more I thought and read about it, and the more I talked to other trans people, I realized that it's actually not that unusual or surprising that it took me so long, because I grew up in a world where either I was told trans people didn't exist, or they were absolutely disgusting, hideous freaks. You know, one of the earliest representations of trans people I saw was in the Jim Carrey comedy, Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, where, you know, people might remember that the kind of the climax of the comedy is Jim Carrey discovering he's kissed a trans woman, and he like kind of, you know, convulsively vomits to kind of rid himself of this kind of disgusting contamination. And then he strips the trans woman in front of an audience of people, and everyone else is similarly disgusted. So I'd seen that, you know, at the age of about 6. So of course my childhood brain, you know, kids are smart. Kids are adaptive. Kids learn that they need to modify their behavior to fit in so they can be loved and protected and safe. So of course for my childhood brain, it was not even conceivable to think I might be one of those trans people, because I knew at such a young age that to be trans was to be ostracized, was to be mocked, humiliated, and rejected. So, you know, I swallowed the script I'd been told. I swallowed the idea that I was a woman or a girl and then a woman. And I tried my damnedest to do that well, because that's what I'd been taught led to love and acceptance and safety. And of course, through that time, you know, through my whole life, I did have this profound sense of kind of wrongness and unease with my body, which, you know, I now know is gender dysphoria. But for the longest time, I just thought that's what it meant to live in a body. And, you know, that unease manifested as eating disorders, as, you know, mental illness of various sorts. And then it really took until, you know, my late 20s when, you know, which was in the mid 2010s, when we sort of had this moment of exploding trans representation that's often called the trans tipping point, where I suddenly, you know, saw real trans people like, you know, Laverne Cox on the cover of Time magazine and you know, the TV show Transparent. And I was reading trans novels and I thought, I can kind of see myself in those stories. Does that mean that this like wrongness I've had all the time is not just normal, but it's actually this thing called gender dysphoria? And, you know, that's why trans representation is so important. And that's one of the big reasons I wrote my book, because, you know, you can't be what you can't see if you're not told that being trans and human and loved and having a rich and complex, joyful life is possible. You know, it doesn't become really conceivable for almost anyone.
It's interesting because I also watched Ace Ventura, Pet Detective back in the 90s. And I wouldn't say that I've seen it, you know, for probably not for 25 years. It's not it's not a movie that I typically would go to put in the, you know, to put on as a bit of light entertainment. But like you, I hadn't forgotten that scene at the end, but I'd somehow compartmentalized it in my mind to it just being something that existed in the 90s, which, you know, to an extent, I would hope that a film like that wouldn't be made today. I can't see how it could be gotten away with, which is not to say, of course, that people wouldn't still line up to grotesquely laugh at it. But reading your recount of it, in the chapter where you talk about media representations of trans people and the ways in which, of course, as a young child, you wouldn't be attuned to recognizing that in yourself because of what that would mean or what you were told that should mean. Rereading that scene struck me in a very visceral way, just exactly how monstrous it is. Something I really related strongly to reading the early parts of your book were the sense of dis-ease that you felt in your body. And I can imagine that this is something as well that complicates the ability for trans people to recognize their transness and understand exactly what their gender identity is. That if you're assigned female at birth and you're being socialized and conditioned to be a girl in the world, regardless of whether or not you actually are a girl, then your dis-ease is expected. What girl feels comfortable in their body? So exactly. Patriarchy complicates these things even further, doesn't it? That is something that I think is put on, that is expected because we expect everyone except for cishet men to be uncomfortable in their bodies to some degree, because that is how patriarchy and hierarchies of power maintain themselves.
Yeah, it was, it is really complicated. And, you know, when I said I thought, you know, being uncomfortable in my body was normal, you know, in a way that's, was thinking what you just said, that I thought it was normal for women, you know, that women were taught under patriarchy to hate their bodies. And, you know, so when I was a teenager, I had, you know, quite a severe eating disorder and, you know, kind of associated with compulsive exercise, which was really around this idea to have an incredibly thin, angular body. Now, looking back, I can really see that as a sign of my transness. You know, there's lots of research to show that trans kids have incredibly high rates of eating disorder that often kick in around puberty, because puberty is when our bodies develop our secondary sex characteristics that we often find so uncomfortable. So, you know, as a kid, like, you know, boys and girls have pretty similar bodies. You know, we could all just be a bit androgynous, but all of a sudden when I developed breasts and hips and my period, I was kind of confronted with this visceral evidence of my womanness. And I found that really uncomfortable. And I wanted to, you know, I now see that I kind of wanted to be thin and angular because I found my womanness so difficult and confronting. But of course, at the time, like, it just seemed like a typical teenage girl thing to do. I mean, this was like in 2002, this was like peak, you know, Paris Hilton, Keira Knightley, uber skinny kind of, you know.
Very low cut jeans.
Yeah, very low cut jeans, you know, like lots of midriff. Like being uber thin was the fashion. So, you know, at the time it just seemed like, oh, this is just like another like angsty white teenage girl wanting to be as skinny as possible. And the desire to be thin is about patriarchy, not about transness. So it really is a kind of complicated terrain where it can be really hard to unpick, you know, the two, because even though I'm not a woman, I'm still was socialized as a woman and I still live under patriarchy. So of course my relationship to my body is influenced by that. And, you know, that's kind of yet another reason it took me so long to kind of recognize my transness for what it was. And I suppose it was something I wanted to really draw out in my book, the kind of the messiness that so often actually dogs trans experience. You know, I think we're often, again, with these really simplistic media representations, we're often sold this story of transness, that the trans person knows who they are from when they're a kid. There's no ambiguity. Like they just, you know, if they're assigned female, they're like a total tomboy. They refuse to wear dresses. And they might become, you know, a really butch kind of presenting person and then try and get surgery and hormones at the earliest opportunity. And what, like, that story is true for some people, but not for everyone. And what it means is that for people like me who, you know, we don't conform to that script, we really start to kind of doubt our own experience and kind of gaslight ourselves and have all this imposter syndrome. Think, you know, if I was really trans, I would have known earlier and been more sure of myself. When, of course, the reality is, like, we live in a world that, like, hates trans people. So it's, you know, that tells us it's, you know, it's a monstrous, unhuman thing. So, of course, it's not surprising that it would be a kind of complicated, convoluted process to recognize that in yourself.
There's something as well, and I'm curious about your thoughts on this too, that very strict, I mean, reinforcing the idea that if you're really, quote, air quotes around really, if you're really trans, then you would know from a young age, because of course you would be mimicking the binary in your, it's sort of the idea that the binary exists whether or not you're trans or cis kind of needs to be dismantled, doesn't it? Because obviously trans girls are not necessarily always very, very feminine, and trans boys are not necessarily always very tomboyish, and non-binary children may float between either expression or accepted expression of gender, or they may be very strongly one or the other.
Yeah, completely. I mean, this kind of born in the wrong body, know when you're a kid, feel really certain about it kind of trans narrative. You know, it's really influenced by medical understandings of transness, which are really wedded to the gender binary. Like the idea that, you know, if someone like me is not the girl I was assigned, then I must be a boy and I must express that boyness in really, really normative ways through being like, you know, like playing with trucks and then later, you know, wanting to be really mask and built and, you know, monosyllabic. And you know, this idea, again, it's true for some people, but it's really, it can do a lot of harm because, as you've sort of gestured towards, it erases all the many, many people who are trans and whose genders don't fit into the categories of man or women. Of course, you know, there are trans men and trans women who very much identify with those identities. But there's this whole other universe of people who are non-binary, genderqueer, transmasculine, transfeminine, and their identities and their gendered expression is just, you know, can be fluid, it's complex, and they don't fit into this, you know, very narrow gender binary, which, concerningly, the medical profession still really kind of enforces when they're dealing with trans bodies, because, you know, it's still you know, very much the case in Australia that even though being trans is no longer considered a disease, which, you know, is a plus, you still need to get a formal diagnosis of gender dysphoria if you, as a trans person, want to obtain any like medical gender affirming treatments like hormones or surgery. And to get that diagnosis, you really have to kind of squash what, you know, will often be a really complex story into these really neat binary script of saying, of, you know, saying that you kind of essentially want to look like, you know, or want to exist as the gender opposite to that you were assigned at birth. So, you know, it means for someone like me, when I went to get my diagnosis, you know, I really kind of had to spin a story where I had to sort of say, oh yes, you know, I did play with trucks as a kid and wanted to be, you know, like my brother and wanted to be with the boys, and kind of, you know, edit out, you know, the fact that I also like to play with Barbies and do dress ups and wear pink and all those kind of more complex signs of gender expression I had. So it's, you know, this binary still is incredibly powerful in how it's used to police trans lives. And I think it's important to remember that this binary kind of serves no one except patriarchy. You know, patriarchy is invested in the gender binary because it creates this kind of neat assumption where the world is divided into men and women and everything masculine is better than everything feminine. And, you know, so trans people can be invested in challenging the gender binary, but cisgender people can also as well, because they're equally harmed by it. You know, cis women are harmed by the idea that they are, you know, they represent the kind of the complete opposite of the masculine, which is superior. And then, of course, cis men are also harmed by it because they're boxed into this really narrow idea of what the masculine must be, and they're forced to also kind of distort and repress themselves. So, you know, binary is just no good altogether. We need to get rid of it.
100% agree on that. It's really, you know, particularly from a patriarchal kind of perspective, which is obviously what I'm more well-versed in, it's so sad that this, obviously, dismantling the gender binary is not the only thing that we need to do to dismantle patriarchy, but it's a pretty huge part of it. And this one thing that would certainly help to liberate a lot of people, including the cis men who feel like patriarchy might represent them best, the one thing that we could do is still so terrifying to so many people. But I suppose that also comes back to the fact that the representation has been so poor, so limited, and so intimidating, you know, that way, it's like this way lies monsters, you know.
Yeah.
But when you get there, I mean, you reference Alison Evans, the non-binary young adult novelist, their book Gender Euphoria, which kind of explores gender expression through a mystical, magical, adventurous kind of lens. It's really troubling that we're at this point in history where we've apparently progressed so far and people are still resisting opening themselves up to joy.
I totally agree. I think there's maybe two things going on. I think there's certainly that, you know, things are getting better, but still the trans representation we have is still so much around, you know, trauma. It's a lot of it is trauma porn that focuses on the difficult aspect of being trans, the gender dysphoria, the stigma, the transphobia, being an outsider. So of course, you know, being trans, living outside the gender binary is still a kind of stigmatized, fearful thing with negative connotations, which, you know, a lot of people are afraid of. But I also think there's this element that cisgender people who have really rigorously followed the rules of the gender binary in their own lives and really, you know, become their own gender police, I think they find the idea of non-binary people and collapsing the gender binary quite threatening and confronting, because it's sort of, it's suggesting that the rules that they have lived their lives by and rules that may have caused pain need not apply, that they didn't need to do that. Like, they didn't need to kind of you know, contort themselves into these boxes. And that's a really confronting and scary thing. I mean, I have so much empathy for that because, you know, I resent that I spent years trying to be a good woman and, you know, do all the things I was meant to do. And, you know, I feel resentful of that. I wish I'd learned about these ideas earlier. But so I think for some people discovering these ideas when it so goes against the gender roles they have lived by and thought they had to live by, that their response can kind of be a bit fear-based and defensive and say, well, no, that can't be true because I've done this and therefore this must be the way things have to be.
It's like any group of, you know, it's like women who are maybe in their 60s or 70s who might be guilty of saying, well, I had to deal with this when I was a young mother, so therefore it should never be easy for you. Or I remember Lindy West's wonderful episode of This American Life where she confronted one of her trolls who had, you know, sent her horrific, harassed her horribly online, and it turned out that he was a fellow fat person who was really confronted by the fact that she lived joyfully in her own body and he hadn't yet understood how that could be possible for him. So I guess on that note, I really want to talk about trans joy, and I want to talk about the political power of living joyfully in your body and in yourself. In the first part of the book, you write about how you're beginning, well, you're so beautifully kind of touch on the fact that you can't isolate a beginning understanding of your transness, because it could be this, it could be that, it could be a whole collection of different things. But one of the circumstances that you write about is being in Canada and buying some legal THC capsules there and going on a, you know, taking a few and getting a little bit nicely stoned, which you had never really been before. And suddenly, in, you know, that kind of wash of, you call it the golden glow that goes through your body when you're a bit stoned, becoming very aware of your body in this way that seemed, as I was reading it, to bring you joy.
Yeah. I mean, I think, as you've said, like, I have many kind of moments of trans beginning, but that was a particularly glorious one that made me feel incredibly free in my body and prompted this moment of clarity the next morning, which was, you know, I woke up after being a bit stoned with this sentence in my mind that was, you know, wearing women's clothes is drag, you're not really a woman. And, you know, I suppose if someone had told me, you know, that I was going to be trans, I might have assumed, or discover I was going to be trans, I might have assumed that would be a moment of kind of fear and consternation, thinking, oh no, I've got to like become part of this marginalized group and my life's going to be really hard. But actually, that moment of clarity the morning after my THC adventures was a moment of such immense joy, of real gender euphoria. It was this real sense of, now I get it. Now I understand why I felt so wrong in my body all these years. And I don't have to keep living like this. There's another way. I had this real sense of doors opening, this sort of sense that I realized that woman had been a kind of a character I'd been kind of miscast into. And I didn't have to do it anymore. I could say no. Like, I could walk off the stage and say, sorry, there's been a mistake. Not actually a woman. Gonna do my own, you know, casting from now on and be who I really am. And, you know, that was my first probably glimpse of what trans people call gender euphoria, of feeling incredibly good in our body. And, you know, but there's been so many other moments since then. You know, it's really true that what we don't talk about enough is that closeted trans lives are often a bit miserable because we're repressing this huge part of who we really are and putting so much energy into hiding ourselves and, you know, trying to, be, you know, follow a script of someone else. And there's just this enormous liberation in letting that go and saying, no, actually, you know, I'm not going to play that role anymore. Mm. And so even though being trans is, challenging because we live in a world that is incredibly transphobic still. It also, for me at least, and I think for many people I know, is just accompanied by this extraordinary sense of lightness and freedom and kind of sense of being impressed with oneself, really, like of having the guts to finally do this. Because, you know, I am still such a rule follower. And, you know, always want to be the kind of person who ticks all the boxes and gets the gold star and the A plus at the end and, you know, a pat on the head from the teacher. So for me to kind of have the courage to say, no, I refuse. I'm not going to do that. Was the scariest thing I've ever done, but was also the thing I'm most proud of in my life. And that pride in myself, I kind of carry around every day now as a sense of, I suppose it's a sense of kind of dignity and a sense of being able to trust myself in a way I never had before.
Mm. That's such a beautiful point to segue to the questions. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Please note my disclaimer that neither Eve nor I are medical doctors, although Eve is a doctor, lawyers or professionally trained counsellors. We're just two humans with a little thing called life experience and a fondness for poetry. Questioning asks, honestly, I'm nervous to even send this email. I don't want to hurt anyone or imply anything about anyone except for myself. I'm trying to work out the best way to ask this because I absolutely do not want to imply that my experience is representative of all assigned male at birth non-binary people. The too long didn't read of it is, I'm not sure if I'm non-binary or I just don't care about my own pronouns. Recently, I've been questioning whether I might be non-binary. This obviously isn't problematic in and of itself, but I'm trying to be self-critical of my thought process. I was raised male with parents who were very supportive of me in every way. I've never felt that I was particularly masculine and always felt like I didn't fit in around blokey blokes. What I do know is that my heart feels bigger when I hear content from people such as Liv Hewson and Scout Boxall. The crux of this issue is that I don't care at all what pronouns are used to refer to me, and I don't feel that gender really affects me at all. In my case, and I want to make it clear that I'm not speaking on behalf of anyone else, I'm very aware that this comes at least in part from my white, cis, questioning mark, male privilege. I've never had to worry about gender due to my socialization, and I'm aware that this is a huge source of privilege. Do you have any thoughts about how to navigate this? Thanks in advance.
That's a really beautiful and thoughtful question. I mean, you know, firstly, good on you for being so self-aware of the way in which being socialized as a cis male means gender isn't, you know, necessarily such a source of kind of angst and torment as it is, you know, as we've been discussing, for many cis women and a lot of trans and non-binary people. But I suppose I'd also kind of encourage this questioner to maybe cut themselves a bit of slack and acknowledge how brave it is to be asking these questions and to say that if you're asking yourself extensively over a period of time if you're non-binary or trans, I think there's a pretty high likelihood that you might be. Because, you know, cis people don't, you know, lie in bed at night awake wondering if they're trans. Like, they know they're cis. I think if you're asking yourself these questions and really resonating with, you know, non-binary or trans content that other creators are putting out there, you know, it might be the case that you are. I mean, no one can define that for yourself except you. You know, this is something really important to me, that even though, you know, the medical profession still has this diagnosis of gender dysphoria and transness, I think it's really important to insist that all being non-binary or trans is having a disconnect between the gender you are assigned based on your biological sex and the gender you actually are, the gender you feel yourself to be. And that is such an internal and private feeling that each individual is the only person who can make that call for themselves. No one else has any idea, I would say. I don't actually think it's relevant, you know, what your gender expression looks like, you know, if you are really gender conforming or not, if you really care about pronouns or not. The only thing that really matters is whether you feel that disconnect within yourself or not. And if you feel you're non-binary, you probably are. and you can kind of do with that what you will. I mean, it can, you know, for some non-binary people, it's not really a big deal. Like, they don't really care about, you know, coming out or changing their pronouns. And that's cool. And but then for other people like myself, you know, it was huge. I changed my pronouns. I changed my name. I changed everything about my life. But that's just part of the wonderful diversity of non-binary and trans experience. So, you know, I suppose I'd just encourage the questioner to be kind to yourself, be gentle, keep asking the questions, acknowledge the bravery and the integrity of what you're doing, and listen to your own gut and kind of try and ignore all the white noise from everything else.
Such a beautiful, sensitive answer to, as you said, a very self-aware question. I obviously, disclaimer, I'm coming at this from the perspective of someone who is cis, so I can't at all speak to the trans experience of this, and nor would I attempt to. But in terms of the understanding of, or in terms of the acknowledgement that the questioner is making of their perceived cis maleness, whether or not that is actually what they are, I wonder if there is something at play as well in, you know, they acknowledge that they have had a lot of privilege in their life, and there's a sense of that kind of, you know, what you write about in your book, Eve, of if you're not aware of it early on, then are you, how can you claim it? Or, you know, the imposter syndrome, that I can imagine that for someone who has been socialized as a cis man, there is what there might be a self-sabotaging voice inside that comes from transphobia and also comes from patriarchy that says, well, who are you to reject this power that you have?
Yeah. I think that's such a good point that, you know, if you're born into and socialized what was seen as the apex of, you know, of gender, being a cis white man, yeah, there are so many really noisy messages saying, you know, you've hit the jackpot. Why would you give that up? And I think it's important to point out that, you know, there are real consequences to giving up cis privilege. You know, I had no idea how much cis privilege was useful in my life, or, you know, smoothed out my life until I lost it. And it was really confronting for me to feel like, you know, I was the same person I always was, but because I was now trans, I was suddenly treated differently and, you know, experienced transphobia and all these things. And, you know, that was quite, in a way, embarrassing for me, because it made me realize how naive I had been about my privilege beforehand. And but it was also an actually really valuable, I suppose, eye-opening education. Because it gave me a much improved kind of embodied awareness of how privilege and structural oppression works on an embodied level. And I think it gave me much more empathy with other oppressed peoples. You know, I'm still very ignorant because I don't share their embodied experience, but I am much more attuned to and empathetic towards disabled people and people of colour and First Nations people and the kind of microaggressions they live with daily, because I now experience microaggressions as well in a way I really hadn't before. So I think, you know, it is important to acknowledge that cis privilege is real and giving it up is scary, but, you know, it comes with pain, but it also comes with immense gifts of, you know, insight and empathy.
I'm curious as well about this, you know, in terms of stepping away from power and stepping into power, however, you know, illusory it might be, however much of an illusion it might be. In your book, you write, there's a line that I dog-eared the page on it. You write about being in a cafe and you have recently become aware of your transness and the fact that you are not a woman, and you see a grizzled old boomer, you know, the apex, as you said, of cis white male privilege, wearing a Rolex. You say the type of man who's always known himself to be the protagonist of every story, the loudest voice in every room, the type of man I resent and fear and obey, which of course is the power that patriarchy has over us. But some of the conversations that I've had with trans men and with non-binary trans mask people who have previously been feminist, or who are still feminist, obviously, but who will say of themselves, I was socialized as a girl and I have a feminist understanding of what it means to be seen as a girl in the world, that there was a conflict inside about what it meant to recognize that actually they were either men or they were non-binary trans mask people who were stepping into a system that they also hated.
Yeah, it was so, so confronting for me, that exact issue. And one of the hardest things I really had to grapple with, that I'd, you know, been really raised in this kind of, I suppose, like girl power kind of 90s feminism of like, yay, you're a girl.
I love how you called it a pallid form of feminism, yeah. Which I thought was such a good way of putting it.
It was pretty pallid. Because it was just that idea of, you know, girls are awesome, girls can do everything that boys can do. And it was, you know, it was pretty blind to a lot of bigger structural issues. But that was really the dogma I'd been raised in. So I'd sort of been really trained to, I suppose, you know, embrace my girlness or my womanness and want to use that to kind of show that women and girls could be equal to men and do everything they could do. I suppose it was sort of in a way similar to a bit of a girl boss feminism, like that, you know, women can be CEOs too, which, you know, is obviously not a feminism I subscribe
Yay,
to now.
Yay, patriarchy solved.
I know, but I'd been, you know, trained to think that, you know, you don't want to emulate men, you want to kind of show that you can break the glass ceiling with your big shoulder pads as a kind of high femme girl boss, which, you know, side bracket is perhaps a form of emulating men anyway, but I'd been really told to sort of, you know, that you want to be a woman feminist. So to kind of see in myself this hunger for masculinity, to want to look male, be read as male, and inhabit that in the world was enormously confronting. I really felt for a very long time that this was just internalized misogyny, that I'd been taught to hate the feminine parts of myself, the woman in myself, and, you know, that my brain had kind of convinced itself that this was the out, just to become a man and to kind of win in team patriarchy. And this was another huge part of my imposter syndrome, that it felt, I suppose, like a betrayal of my feminism to want to, you know, affirm my gender to become more masculine. And it took me, you know, a really long time and a lot of conversations with other non-binary and transmasculine people to realize, you know, that that's actually not the case. That, A, you know, being a transmasculine person or a trans man or a non-binary person is not the same as being a cis man. Like, you don't have the same privileges and entitlements. You know, you've still been socialized as a woman, so you're never going to lose that awareness of what it feels like to be in a woman's body and to live under patriarchy in that sense. So you always will have a profoundly different subject position to a cis man. And also, I suppose what I've been thinking of a lot recently is the way in which, I suppose, trans masculinity can be a form of redemption for masculinity generally, you know, in a world where we're kind of grappling with toxic masculinity and it's causing so much harm in so many contexts, that I think more and more trans masculine people who really get, you know, misogyny and patriarchy because they've lived in female socialized bodies can provide examples of what it means to be manly and masculine in ways that are beautiful and strong but without being misogynist, without being toxic, without kind of refuting the feminine and the incredible glory that all that represents. So, I mean, this is an idea that I'm kind of just developing, and it's something I'm keen to discuss further. But I now, I suppose, see transmasculinity not as a betrayal of feminism, but as a core part in the feminist project of dismantling patriarchy, because it's a route, it's an avenue to offer alternative, healthier models of masculinity, which we all, of course, desperately need.
Absolutely. And just to be very clear, I was not at all suggesting that transmasculinity was a rejection of feminism. But it just so no one misinterprets that at all.
But
by the same token as well, this person asking this question, I really liked what you said about if you're lying awake at night asking yourself this question, then there's probably some truth to it, because cis people generally don't lie awake unless it's an intellectual curiosity. Could I be? But if you're routinely asking that question and feeling that way, then there's probably something more going on. By the same token, there is something really expansive to be had in people who've been understood by the world to be cis men, even when they're not, stepping outside of that and exhibiting that kind of bravery. All trans experiences are brave, and I imagine that they are brave in many similar ways, in some ways they are unique. Exhibiting that kind of unique bravery to stand before the world and say, actually, I'm not that. I'm this, and this is a different way to be, and this is how we can continually expand what our understanding of humanity is and what our understanding of a human expression of life is. And as you quote, you know, the German poet Rilke, is that how you say it? Rilke?
Yeah, Rilke, yeah. Yeah.
As you quote Rilke, you know, to live the questions rather than searching always for the answers, to live the questions.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's really a line I live by and have tattooed on my wrist. And on that point, I think it's really essential to point out, I suppose, the kind of the particular bravery of assigned male people coming out as non-binary or transfeminine or, you know, any iteration of being not cis. That, you know, people who are read as male by the world, who exhibit feminine gender expression, are incredibly heavily policed and experience probably the most intense transphobia. You know, someone like me, a transmasc person, I can walk down the street and not be harassed because I'm just kind of read as like an androgynous person, a kind of, you know, maybe like a butch person. People don't really register me, but, you know, people who are perceived as men who wear jewelry or makeup or skirts, that's a really brave thing to do because, you know, the combination of misogyny and homophobia and transphobia mean that any kind of femininity attached to what we think of as a male body is so heavily policed and shamed and, you know, can lead to really, you know, violent repercussions. So to transgress, you know, perceived maleness in that way is its own special class of bravery. And I take my hat off to all those people who do that because I haven't had to do that myself.
Well, as you said, it's a threat to what could be. It's a threat to what is that promises what could be.
Yeah, because every man who's, you know, made himself smaller by repressing his emotions and repressing his feminine side and being really, you know, mask and muscly, for every man like that who was, you know, he is threatened by seeing men who refuse to do that, men who, whether they're cis or not, display their femininity, that's a huge threat to all the men who have repressed themselves. And that threat, you know, often can lead to, you know, violence or hostility or aggression because, you know, we're poor silly humans who, when we feel threatened or afraid, we often react with violence.
I just want to touch on one last thing that you actually write about in the first few pages of your book, and it's a concept or a phrase that I have understood, but have only recently been had seen it put into words. And it's not anything like super deep or anything like that. But you wrote about the first time you tweeted out to the world, "I am trans," and it was in response to some terrible transphobia that was being propagated by the right-wing media, the Daily Telegraph. And then you reference saying something about dealing with the vulnerability hangover. And I read that and I was like, I'm familiar with the idea of what that is, but I've never until recently really had people put that into words, the vulnerability hangover. And I wanted to just talk a little bit about that because, you know, for anyone listening who may not know what that means, I guess the idea is that when you are open and you invite people into something, into share something that is very deeply personal to you, that you end up having that shame afterwards. You sort of fall into the shame spiral. And I experience vulnerability hangovers all the time. In fact, I was talking to my friend Alice Robinson, who's a wonderful writer. She's been on the podcast a couple of times already. I was telling her last night about, Eve wrote in their book about the vulnerability hangover, and I'm really interested in that concept. And she was like, I don't know what that means. And I explained it to her and she said, oh, that's my life every day. Just a hangover of vulnerability. So what is it about, what is the power that comes from being vulnerable in this way, and how can we resist that urge to fall into the shame spiral of it?
It's a great question. I should say first that the phrase vulnerability hangover comes from Brené Brown, who many people may have heard of, you know, as one of the world's leading researchers on shame and vulnerability. And, you know, I've read a lot of her work and been pretty influenced by her ideas. And I think she coined this term, the vulnerability hangover, to talk about the very first TED talk she gave, the one that went viral, where she kind of announced her own story. You know, she'd been an academic researcher to that date, then in the TED talk kind of put her own story on the line the first time. And, you know, it really resonated and it made her famous. But for the next week, she said she had a vulnerability hangover where she felt so ashamed of making herself vulnerable and could barely leave the house. Mm. And I think many of my thoughts on vulnerability, again, are indebted to Brené Brown, that I think we're taught to see it as shameful and exposing because we're sold this lie that being invulnerable is, you know, gives us armor, gives us protection in life. And then if we take that armor away and show who we really are, show our fears and our messy underside, you know, we'll just get abandoned or, you know, stabbed in our kind of vulnerable parts. And I think that, you know, that fear never goes away. Like, I still get vulnerability hangovers every day. I'll probably get one after recording this podcast.
Me too.
Great. But what I've realized, and that's just our lizard brain, I think, like being really, you know, trying to keep us safe, like, you know, in the kind of clumsy ways it knows how. But the truth is, you know, vulnerability is the kind of key ingredient for a meaningful, connected, happy life, because vulnerability is the route to connection. You know, I've formed the most powerful relationships of my life since coming out as trans because, you know, as I mentioned at the start, when I was talking about my friendship with Claire, saying who I was to other people, being vulnerable, created space for them to be vulnerable with me and say who they really were and to connect over that. You know, and just since my book has come out, I've had so many wonderful, you know, emails and DMs from readers who've, you know, thanked me for my vulnerability because it's enabled them to see parts of themselves or to, you know, feel affirmed in their own transness. And, you know, that is incredibly meaningful and rewarding as well. So, you know, it's, I think it's kind of like anything in life, that you need to feel the fear, you need to take a risk to get to the really juicy, good, you know, meaty feelings of life. And it's scary, but it's also pretty fail-safe because of course there'll always be haters, but you know, what I've learned is that people who mock you for being vulnerable and brave, they are not people worth respecting. They're not people worth your time. So being vulnerable is actually really, really good screening technique of who you want in your life or not. you know, the good people, the loving people, the people with integrity, they will always celebrate and reward vulnerability, and everyone else you can just forget about.
Mm. Yeah, that resonates very strongly with me. And, you know, I experience vulnerability hangovers all the time, particularly because a lot of the work that I do now, you know, and had to kind of start doing this during the pandemic because everyone's work was shut down. So I was like, shit, how am I going to make my rent each week? I'm going to have to pivot wildly and become a content creator, which has been enormously rewarding because, as you said, you end up being invited to share people's private personal stories and they tell you how your work has impacted their life. What an incredible privilege that is. But there are times even now when I, you know, feel afterwards like, oh, maybe I was a little bit too open there. Maybe I shared a little bit too much of my feelings. And it's not so much for me, it's not so much that I feel ashamed of having been vulnerable. It's the fear that other people will think that the vulnerability is a pretense. Does that make sense? And so you sort of feel like, or have you been, I guess it's all that gaslighting that you kind of experienced throughout your life as well, where you're like, did I take that the wrong way? Am I being too sensitive? Am I being too, because vulnerability is something that has been stamped out of all of us because we need people to not be vulnerable in order to maintain systems of oppression. We need them to not question them and not show human need. But one of the things that I've been reflecting on recently is how you cannot be an activist or a fighter or anyone who is, even if you don't consider yourself those things, anyone who is trying to change the world in some way, whether or not it's just your small part of it or whether or not it's a bigger portion of it, change it for the better, unless you temper that kind of hard exterior with the soft underbelly. You have to have those two things in place. Otherwise, you kind of forget what the point of it all is.
Mm. And totally. And I do, you know, it is really important to balance them. Like, it's exhausting to be vulnerable all the time. And I think the point you made about social media is really important and relevant because, you know, there is, you know, for people like us writing, trying to build an audience, put work out in the world, I think it can feel like there's a lot of pressure to be constantly bearing our soul to create content and engage with people, which can be really meaningful. But it also, I think, can, I suppose, transgress boundaries and make us feel like there's sort of nothing left for ourselves as individuals. So I think it's a really tricky, delicate balancing act, and it's going to be different for every individual and will evolve over time. But for me, yeah, it's important to be vulnerable when it matters and where I feel like it will make an impact, but also recognize that I don't owe the world everything. And, you know, particularly, you know, marginalized people, where we're often expected to kind of sell the world our story, and that's our ticket to becoming known, to kind of give our trauma porn over, and, you know, in response or in return we get readers or an audience. And you know, we don't owe the world anything. Like, we can keep our story to ourselves as much as we want. You know, being vulnerable is useful and can be really meaningful, but we don't owe the world our vulnerability. And we can actually put a hard exterior up if we feel like that's what serves us at a particular moment in time.
Eve, it has been such a pleasure and delight to talk to you. Your book is so beautifully written, as I said, and provides so many different light bulb moments, but in this very kind of poetic, lyrical way, which makes reading and the act of reading about other people's lives so enjoyable. I've been so thrilled having you on the podcast this week, and I could talk to you for a lot longer. And hopefully one day we'll be able to, if we ever get back to, you know, socializing.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, and it's been an absolute delight. You've asked wonderful questions, and hope to have a coffee or a drink in person one day when we finally get out of this lockdown.
I would love that. The book is all about Eve, Notes from a Transition. It is out now. It's available in all good bookstores. Please, where you can, shop independent. And also, don't forget that you can borrow books from the library and authors still receive a portion of payment for that. So don't worry. I have a lot of people sometimes write to me and say, what's the best way that I can buy your book so that you get the most out of it? But don't think about it like that. The best thing is just to read the book and tell other people to read the book. And, you know, if you need to borrow it from the library, then that's great too. Please do read it though. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful contribution, not just to the oeuvre of trans stories and narratives that celebrate trans lives, but also just the celebration of life in general, because they should not be considered as separate things. This story is equally as relevant to you, even if your experience is not a trans one. Eve, it's been an enormous pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Big Sister Hotline, a weekly advice podcast that delivers no-nonsense words with love from the kind of people you know have your back. Your big sisters. Big thanks to Acast, who are the best podcast hosts you could wish for. And if you enjoy the hotline, you can support the ongoing making of it at my Patreon, which is allthews.patreon.com/Clementine Ford. And you might also consider rating and reviewing it, because it's really nice to have the feedback. Don't forget, you can submit questions to bigsisterhotline@gmail.com. And don't worry, all submissions are treated as totally anonymous. We're big sisters, and we've got your back. My guest this week has been Dr. Eve Rees, an historian, researcher, and now memoirist, author of the book All About Eve, a stunning journey through identity, transition, and what it means to live the questions of one's life. It is a joyful exploration of trans identity, celebration, and pride, and you can buy it from your local independent bookstore or borrow it from your local library. Remember, there's no topic too thorny and no question too weird for the Big Sister Hotline. We're here for all the questions you don't want to ask your therapist, especially now that it has to be over Zoom. So contact us instead. The Big Sister Hotline. The phone lines are open.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.